Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's gubernatorial candidates announced their running mates, which in one case might mean some political realignment.
It's no secret that I was a strong Marco Rubio supporter, but that election is done, and I'm looking forward to this election.
Also this week, we'll get some analysis on Florida's gubernatorial candidate choices for lieutenant governor.
Traditionally, it probably wasn't the best choice, but this may work out just fine for them.
We'll also get the latest on the actual governor's race itself, hear about the ethics issue dogging the Democrat in the contest, and learn what state constitutional amendments may and may not survive legal challenges to make it onto the November ballot. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Just over a week after winning their respective races for governor, Republican Ron DeSantis and Democrat Andrew Gillum announced their running mates. As Brendan Byrne from member station WMFE in Orlando reports, the selection for DeSantis is state lawmaker Janet Nunez, and for Gillum, it's his former gubernatorial opponent, Orlando businessman Chris King.
During a Facebook Live announcement, King said he gained respect for Gillum during the primary race.
This is not a political marriage. This is not a marriage of convenience.
That's right.
I developed a friendship with Andrew Gillum over 18 months as we were competing.
King touted the campaign's platform like affordable housing, access to health care, battling gun violence, and criminal justice reform. Republican candidate Ron DeSantis' running mate, Janette Nunez, has been a member of the Florida House of Representatives since 2010, representing a district in Miami. She faced criticism for a tweet back in 2016 slamming then-candidate Trump, who has endorsed DeSantis' campaign as president.
It's no secret that I was a strong Marco Rubio supporter, but that election is done, and I'm looking forward to this election.
DeSantis said Nunez will help the state build on its economic success and lead an education reform. Gillum and King face DeSantis and Nunez in the general election November 6th. I'm Brendan Byrne in Orlando.
We'll take a deep dive into the governor's race a little later on in Capitol Report, but before we do, let's get a bit deeper into that whole lieutenant governor thing and what, if any, impact it's likely to have on the overall contest. Meanwhile, Florida Public Radio's Sasha Kordner spoke to University of Central Florida political scientist Aubrey Jewett to discuss the Republican and Democrat running mates, whether picking a lieutenant governor matters, and if the right choices were made on each ticket.
So let's start off first with Janette Nunez, Republican Ron DeSantis' choice for lieutenant governor. Was she the right choice for his ticket?
Yeah, I think actually she's probably about the best choice he could make in terms of getting elected. She's Hispanic, she's from South Florida, and she's a woman. And what the early polls have shown is that DeSantis needs to do better among women, and that he needs to do really well among Hispanics if he is going to beat his Democratic opponent. And so I think that this is a pretty solid choice.
And something people are bringing up is a tweet from Nunez a couple years ago when she was supporting Rubio for president. It's in terms of the Never Trump movement and kind of insinuating that President Trump supported the KKK and he's the biggest con man there is. Do you think that harms DeSantis in any way or just doesn't matter?
I don't think that a tweet like that is going to matter too much to most voters. It might matter to a few. But, you know, as you think this through, it seems to me that the people that might be most upset with that would be Trump supporters. And the fact of the matter is that Ron DeSantis, you know, is strongly supporting Donald Trump. So I don't think that any of those Trump supporters would say, oh, I'm not going to vote for you know, my Republican choice, Ron DeSantis, because of this. Now, of course, you know, for independent voters who may, of course, it may come down to the swing voters, the independent voters, once again, if both bases seem firmly behind their party. Yeah, it's possible, again, for a few voters that this may irritate them. Maybe it's people that were on the fence on Trump and they see this and they think, oh, he supports the KKK. You know, I can't vote for them. On the other hand, it may, again, work the other way or have no influence.
Well, what about Chris King, Democrat Andrew Gillum's pick for lieutenant governor?
In a traditional way of thinking about it, it maybe was not the best choice he could make, because he basically picked someone that was as far to the left or even possibly more to the left than he was, because Chris King was really out there plugging away with very progressive policies. He probably had some of the most progressive and most detailed set of policy positions of anybody in the Democratic race. And so I'm not sure, you know, ideologically, he doesn't do much to bring the Democratic Party together. And he didn't do that well in the primary. He spent about $5 million and got about 3.5% of the vote. So on the other hand, as I said, that's sort of the traditional strategy. But, you know, we don't seem to be in traditional times right now, quite frankly. The last few years, when it comes to elections in the country and in Florida, we seem to be breaking some new ground. And so in some ways, I look at this as doubling down, that Gillum is saying, I am running as a very progressive Democrat, pushing liberal policies, and I am going to pick a running mate that has those exact same views and maybe even more so, and we are going to change the face of the Democratic Party of Florida. And so it's a bold choice. And in this election, you know, it may work for them. The thought is that a lot of Democrats who are not as liberal or progressive, they may still stick with this ticket because they don't like Donald Trump. And Ron DeSantis is really associated so strongly with Donald Trump. And so Democrats, even if they weren't thrilled with Gillum and King as their choice at the top of the ticket, maybe they would have been much more comfortable with, say, Gwen Graham. They're still going to probably vote Democratic when push comes to shove. So, you know, perhaps, you know, maybe it'll work.
And it's kind of interesting because you brought up Gwen Graham, and I know some had even thought he may pick Gwen Graham, and you were talking about uniting the party. Do you think he would have had a better chance in terms of having a more balanced ticket?
Yes, I think so. I think if he had picked Gwen Graham, that would have done a better job of uniting Democrats. But perhaps, again, maybe he's not as worried about that, and maybe he's right. I don't know, but we'll see. It certainly would have pulled the Democratic Party closely together, since he only beat Graham by a few percentage points. She's a woman. The Democratic ticket's doing quite well among women voters, according to the early polls. But still, you know, having a woman at the top of the ticket, you know, might have helped. Conversely, you could also, you know, if you just look at the geographical balance, you know, Gwen Graham maybe was not an advantage in that respect, because then you would have had both candidates basically being from the capital, Tallahassee, up in North Florida, where there's not a whole lot of people. And so, you know, maybe picking Chris King from Central Florida, you know, at least he's got some geographical balance on the ticket without Graham.
And having said that, there are reports out there saying picking a lieutenant governor doesn't even matter. So to you, is that true?
Well, I think, statistically speaking, it doesn't matter a whole lot who a governor picks as their lieutenant governor choice. That is, when I say statistically speaking, it's not going to impact your vote totals very much. There's been a lot of political science research that's looked at both the choices for vice president for president and lieutenant governors for governors. And by and large, it doesn't matter a lot to most voters. Ultimately, most voters make up their mind based on the top of the ticket. So they're going to be looking at the governor. They're going to be looking at Gillum, and they're going to be looking at DeSantis, and they're going to weigh those two gentlemen, and they're going to weigh the policies and their leadership skills, and that's how they're going to make their vote.
Andy says, having said that, if this is a close race, Jewett says, then perhaps the choice does matter a little bit, whether it's Gillum doubling down on getting the progressive Democratic vote or DeSantis picking a Cuban Hispanic woman from South Florida to get thousands of extra votes that way as well. But bottom line, he says,
it's often said, it's an old cliche, but I do think it's true, is that the first rule of selecting a lieutenant governor candidate is do no harm. So it's kind of like the Hippocratic Oath, only for politicians. You know that a lieutenant governor choice probably is not going to help you immensely no matter what you do, but you want to make sure you don't pick someone that's going to be a drag on the ticket. You know, you do need somebody that's got a clean background, is an able campaigner, not going to stick their foot in their mouth, doesn't have skeletons in their closet and that sort of thing, because that really can come back to bite you.
That was Florida Public Radio's Sasha Cordner speaking to University of Central Florida political scientist Aubrey Jewett. Still to come on Capitol Report, moderate voters will have to decide whether to lean far left or far right in the November governor's race.
It's almost impossible for a third-party candidate to enter a race and win.
A federal investigation could continue to dog the Democrat in the Florida governor's contest, even though he doesn't seem to be the target of the probe.
I don't think that anything has surfaced that he did wrong.
And a Tallahassee judge has kicked three proposed constitutional amendments off the ballot because they bundle several issues into one. But the state argues there's nothing new about that.
For example, votes on who to elect as the president and vice president, a measure that is submitted to the voters as a unified proposal.
Florida voters have clear choices among the major party candidates for governor. Conservative Republican Ron DeSantis and progressive Democrat Andrew Gillum couldn't be more different in their ideologies. And that could leave a large swath of voters scratching their heads in November. Gina Jordan has more about the tough decision ahead for moderates.
Florida has a little more than 13 million registered voters. Former state lawmaker Nancy Argenziano says it speaks volumes that more than 3.5 million of them are registered with minor parties or with no party affiliation. That's why she's returning to the campaign trail as a third-party candidate.
They left those two parties for a reason, and the democratic process, we shouldn't be scared of that. It's time. I've never seen a time in history when the people who have left the two major parties are growing so fast, so rapidly, and I think they deserve an alternative.
Argenziano served in the Florida House and Senate. She was appointed to the Florida Public Service Commission, then left that job and the Republican Party. She became a Democrat, then launched an unsuccessful bid for Congress in 2012 as an independent. She says she doesn't want the extremes of either party.
There's a whole batch of people out there who feel disenfranchised from both parties. They're perceiving as one side is so far to the left, the other is so far bat crazy to the right that they're afraid and they need representation too.
Argenziano is now with the Reform Party, running as lieutenant governor with gubernatorial candidate Darcy Richardson. She calls her ticket the middle of the road alternative. It'll be an uphill battle, says Gregory Koger, political science professor at the University of Miami.
So there's a lot of political science research going back for decades that it's almost impossible for a third-party candidate to enter a race and win on a regular basis. It's just the nature of our electoral system where the person who gets the most votes wins and there's only one office, by its structure, rewards two parties in the long run. It is possible for a third-party candidate to get into the race and sort of mess up the outcome by siphoning away votes from one of the two major candidates. And in that way, it might influence results, but it would be difficult for that person to actually win.
How do these candidates compare to other election years? Do you think that maybe they're more right or more left than usual, or is this pretty normal?
So I think for the Republican Party, it's a continuation of existing trends. For the Democratic Party, it is an interesting choice. I mean, the Florida Democrats, for a lot of statewide races, had nominated more moderate, middle-of-the-road candidates in the past. Andrew Gillum represents, I mean, just a much more progressive brand of policy. On top of that, I mean, he's a relatively young candidate and has, I think, successfully energized a lot of voters who would otherwise not be as interested in voting in Florida's primary elections.
So in situations where the middle of the road candidate isn't evident or isn't there, are moderate voters inclined to simply not choose a candidate? Or do you think they might go for a third party candidate?
For people who are, you know, sort of dedicated voters but have moderate policy views, I think they're going to have to decide which of the two major candidates they are closest to, which direction they want to see for the state of Florida.
So historically, it's tough for third parties, but why haven't we seen a rise in a third party? You know, what would it take to have literally a third party that is a contender?
You would need a great candidate, right? Somebody who's very, who's probably well known. And then you need a lot of money, right? Because it takes money to run a national campaign. And if the candidate doesn't have his or her own money, then you need a lot of donors who are willing to basically spend money on a third party candidate. And that's a huge stopping point, because anybody who wants to actually seriously affect the outcomes of the election or change policy is unlikely to want to invest their money in a candidate who is almost certain to lose. And then last, you need voters who see that there are two major party candidates. They're familiar with the two major parties. Most of them have loyalties to one part or the other that at the end of the day are very hard to shake.
Does anything stand out to you about this particular governor's race?
I mean, two things. On the Republican side, the extent to which DeSantis has identified himself with a president who polls nationally at about 40% and is making the race a referendum on Donald Trump, therefore. And then on the Democratic side, I mean, Andrew Gillum is an African-American candidate, relatively young and relatively progressive. And that's a new type of candidate being nominated in a southern state. And so the obvious comparison is to Georgia, where there's also a relatively younger African-American female nominated for governor there. And so it's very interesting to see where those two elections go, whether it speaks to a different direction for the Democratic Party, that when they're trying to win these southern states, they're going to, you know, be forthrightly progressive and nominate members of minority groups in the United States and make that the forefront of their party.
That was University of Miami political science professor Gregory Koger. He expects the Democrats will benefit from unaffiliated voters who don't have a clear choice on the ballot and will want to vote against the party in power. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
But this Florida governor's race has more drama going for it than just the traditional Republican versus Democrat matchup. There is also, at least on the Democratic side, a lot of additional intrigue related to an ongoing FBI investigation and other questions swirling around Tallahassee City Hall. Florida's Commission on Ethics is investigating a complaint filed against Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum. It calls for a look into two trips Gillum took with lobbyists in 2016 and prompted his campaign to release receipts to show a paper trail. Ryan Daly reports the Democratic gubernatorial candidate's attorney is not optimistic about the matter being resolved before the general election.
The complaint began with a local businessman and frequent critic of City Hall that Gillum is surely familiar with. Erwin Jackson, a fixture at city meetings, previously filed a complaint with the State Ethics Commission that ousted a Tallahassee city manager for taking gifts like pricey football tickets. Jackson claims lobbyists paid for Gillum's trips, one to New York City and one to Costa Rica.
Those two trips, I've modified my initial complaint with a trip to New York where he did that. Now we got a second trip. Where he's taken money and gifts.
The trips were unrelated to Gillum's mayoral post, but he was accompanied by lobbyists on both.
Andrew Gillum went over there with Adam Corey, city lobbyist, and Sean Pittman, city lobbyist.
There, Jackson cites the Costa Rica trip. Gillum's campaign says that trip was part of his wife's birthday celebration.
Andrew Gillum says, yeah, he paid for his as well, but he just paid cash, so he has no credit card receipts. And which most people aren't going to believe.
That's Jackson speaking in June when the complaint was filed. Gillum's attorney, Barry Richard, says Gillum met with an Ethics Commission investigator recently.
They have an investigator who does his research. He interviews people. I don't know if he's finished with his interviews or not. We had an interview with him this past Tuesday, this week, so he had not completed his investigation at least by Tuesday.
Hours after the meeting, Gillum's campaign posted on its website receipts intended to show Gillum did in fact pay his way on the trips. One is a $400 cash withdrawal Gillum says he used to pay for his share of a villa in Costa Rica, which he shared with lobbyists. Richard insists there is nothing inappropriate to be found.
Andrew produced all of his receipts to show that they paid for their food, they paid for their travel, everything they paid for with a credit card, and he gave some cash to Adam to reimburse him for the few nights in the room. So all these things are like, they're being treated like this is a big investigation. There's nothing involved here. Nobody has suggested anybody paid anything for any favors. It's just a bunch of silly business.
There, Richard refers to lobbyist Adam Corey, who is connected to an FBI investigation of corruption in Tallahassee government. Corey's lawyer, Christopher Kies, told the Associated Press his client never received cash reimbursement from Gillum and that Corey won the accommodations in a charity auction. During the trip to New York, Gillum and Corey were accompanied at times by an undercover FBI agent. Together, they saw a Broadway musical, which the campaign says was provided by Gillum's brother through a swap for another concert ticket. Gillum has produced a bill for his hotel stay and says his airfare was paid for through another job he held with the foundation People for the American Way. Again, Richard says it's a non-issue.
He met his brother in New York to go see Hamilton, and his brother gave him a ticket to Hamilton. So there's a big uproar over where did the ticket come from? Did it come from Adam Corey? Because Corey went as well. Adam Corey and Andrew and his brother have been friends since college, and they socialize a lot. But nobody, including Corey, has said that Corey gave them the ticket. And nobody has said that. Andrew got the ticket from his brother. So it's just a speculative issue that is not based on anything.
The Gillum campaign's document dump has become fodder for criticism from his competitor in the governor's race. The campaign for Republican Congressman Ron DeSantis is calling Gillum's release of documents incomplete. Included in the release of Gillum's bank records was a poorly redacted document showing a $15,000 transfer from a savings to checking account made around the time of the trip. The Miami Herald, Politico, and others reported on the transfer, which Richard says is making much out of nothing.
Where it came from was Andrew's savings account, and he transferred it to his checking account to pay expenses.
Though he maintains his client did nothing inappropriate, Richard does not think the Ethics Commission will have a complete finding until after the general election in November. The commission has one more meeting on October 19th before votes are cast. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Florida state troopers are spending this month warning drivers about the dangers of driving while tired. Last year, 28 Floridians died in more than 4,300 car crashes as a result of drowsy driving. Since most drowsy driving crashes involve someone falling asleep at the wheel and leaving the road without attempting to stop, they're among the most serious types of car accidents. 8-year-old Ronshay Dugans was killed 10 years ago this week when her school bus was hit by a truck driver who fell asleep at the wheel. In her honor, legislation was passed in 2010, designating the first week of September as Drowsy Driving Prevention Week. FHP says there are many similarities between drowsy and drunk driving, including swerving between lanes, driving at erratic speeds, and the general inability to focus on the road. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the Constitution Revision Commission wanted to give voters a break in the voting booth by shortening the length of the ballot. But to do so, they bundled several of their proposals, combining multiple issues into one proposal. Now activists say that violates the rights of voters. As Regan McCarthy reports, the issue is expected to go before the Florida Supreme Court.
A Tallahassee judge has ordered three proposed constitutional amendments removed from the Florida ballot. Judge Karen Gevers says because the proposals contain several issues bundled into one, voters cannot be expected to answer with a simple yes or no, as statute requires. For example, one proposal talks about both offshore drilling and vaping in workplaces. Joe Little is the lawyer representing the petitioners in the case.
We're not going to permit drilling in our waters, in Florida waters, and we're not going to permit vaping in workplaces. Now, these are two independent matters and unrelated matters. And it's entirely possible that a person would say, well, I don't think this thing about vaping is of constitutional status. It should not be in the Constitution. I want to vote no. But I want to vote yes for outlawing drilling. I can't have it both ways. I've got to take the package.
Little says there's no reason the state needs to package those items together. Jordan Pratt is the lawyer representing the state. He argues bundling the items is beneficial because it cuts down on what he calls voter fatigue. And he says the items make sense because they both address environmental issues. Pratt goes further to say that while the issues do relate to one another in some way, he thinks that's not a question that's before the court.
Many of the proposals which they challenge do have relevance to each other. They may not, for example, be sufficient to pass if there were a single subject provision that related to the CRC, which indisputably there is not. We're certainly not contending that they're so related that they would constitute a single subject. But even if this court were to review the proposals for some minimal level of relatedness, whatever that might be, within the vagaries of their novel First Amendment or state law theories, that these would pass relevance review.
And Pratt adds there's nothing unusual about asking voters to make decisions on bundled items.
For example, votes on who to elect as the president and vice president, a measure that is submitted to the voters as a unified proposal, even though they could, for example, like a candidate for president of one party and like a candidate for vice president of another party who appear on separate lines of the ballot.
If you know that what's coming is a president and a vice president on the same ballot, and you've been told that for 6 months going into a campaign, and you know that's your two candidates and you have no other choice, then you make the decision for those two people.
That's Robert Barnes, a petitioner in the case and former High Springs City Commissioner. He says there's a difference between a presidential candidate and his running mate sharing a ticket and two largely disparate issues sharing a ticket.
These ballot issues were not properly explained. They pop up on a ballot where really a whole majority of people don't see them before they pop up, and there's no explanation. And the explanation in the title of the ballot amendment, woefully lacking.
The state has appealed Yeaver's ruling. Meanwhile, election supervisors must begin sending ballots to overseas voters this month. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FBRCapReport. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.